Hello and welcome to episode 11 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. Today we're talking about It Ain't Hay, and it ain't. It's a podcast. And I would like to take a moment to introduce myself. I'm Jerry Shario, and to introduce the other guy who's with me here, a man so fancy, he has his chauffeur deliver his punchlines, Mr. Nick Santa Maria.
I'm taking away his gas card. That's it. I'm done. Isn't that a French name, Gascard?
It must be, Gascard.
Yeah, Gascard.
I just did Beauty and the Beast, and I think the bad guy's name was Gascard, yeah.
He had a Gascard.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Jer, thank you for that.
Hey, Nick.
Lovely introduction. And we'll be doing an introduction to some information on this podcast. I am like the king of opening segues. And I just want to mention very quickly that Jerry is a little under the weather today.
Yes.
So he might be slightly quieter than he usually is, but I'm going to try and get around that. But anyway,
I don't think you're going to have much of a problem.
Don't tell Jerry. All right.
Jerry.
All right. So we are today speaking about a film that I had just told Jerry before we started that of their first 11 films, I think this is my least favorite of the bunch. And it's unusual because this is the last one directed by Earl Kenton. This is the third. He said he wanted to direct people who took him a little more seriously. I'm afraid the boys weren't those people. They needed wiggle room. Abbott and Costello needed a director who would say, okay, guys, just come in and do your thing. I'll pick the best one and we'll go. Earl was getting a little, you know, impatient with that kind of attitude. So this is his last with the boys and his least with the boys. Now, the interesting thing about Earl Kenton's movies with the boys is that all three of them are completely different. Mm. Think about it. Pardon My Sarong is a satire on the Paramount Jungle films. The second one is a Whodunit, which is an excellent murder mystery comedy. Mm-hmm. One of the best, I think, ever put on film.
Yeah.
And the third one is, interestingly, an adaptation of a Damon Runyon story that Universal filmed in 1935 with Chester Morris, Gene Parker, and in the comedy lead, Leon Errol, who I love, by the way. And he shows up in The Noose Hangs High and does some great work with Lou in that. But anyway, that was a movie that Universal made right after Mr. Runyon wrote the story in 1934. It was called Princess O'Hara. And they used that title for that movie. And only, what is it? 1935, and this is 1940. They started filming in 42. So only 7 years later, they started remaking the film with Abbott and Costello. Now, we love the boys, right, Jerry? We love the boys.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Now, they're not infallible.
Very true.
Infallible. Yeah. You know, there are times when things didn't exactly fit right. And I think this is one of those films. It's got wonderful moments. Jerry, we both agree that it's got some of the, a couple of the funniest scenes I think they ever did.
Oh, yeah.
The cafeteria scene with Lou and the and the gorillas. And then the race tout scene in the back room, you know? Mm-hmm. They're off in a bunch. I think those are hilariously funny. But there are problems with this film. I have real problems with this film. And we're going to get around to it as we talk. But I think it's important that we know who Damon Runyon is. Mm-hmm. For those of the uninitiated, he was born Alfred Damon Runyon in 1880, and he passed away in 1946. Those are the exact same years that W.C. Fields was on this earth, 1880 till 1946. And in fact, Runyon died 2 weeks before Fields did, when Fields died on Christmas Day. So yeah, he was around for 66 years. He was born in Manhattan, Kansas.
Well, that explains it.
This guy who probably you pictured talked like Sheldon Leonard, you know what
yes.
I mean? He gets in a cab and it's like, take me to 42nd Street and make it, you know, that's what you picture. But he's from Kansas. He's from Kansas.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's 1880. He starts working for newspapers. In 1910, he moves to New York, gets a job with a New York paper, becomes a rather popular sports writer, and eventually just a regular journalist doing great work. He wrote poetry, he wrote short stories, he wrote essays, and so many of his things have been turned into films, you know, film adaptations, starting with my favorite of all is Little Miss Marker with Shirley Temple, Adolphe Manjou, and the beautiful Dorothy Dell, who died at the age of 19 in a car crash right after that movie wrapped. Can you imagine? 19. Wow. And she was great. She was just great. She was Alice Faye great, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't say that lightly because I love Alice Faye. sorry, I just turned into someone else, which some people might think a good thing. Little Miss Marker, in fact, was remade as Sorrowful Jones with Bob Hope. Mm-hmm. And then remade again as 40 Pounds of Trouble with Tony Curtis and Phil Silvers. Mm-hmm. And then it was remade again with Walter Matthau and Julie Andrews as Little Miss Marker again. And they were all lousy. the Hope one is probably the best of the bunch. But Little Miss Marker, the original, you can't beat it. It's just terrific. So, yeah, Runyon was popular with comedians. Hope also did Lemon Drop Kid. Mm-hmm. Joey Brown did A Very Honorable Guy. And, you know, Joey Brown, who was very aware of his audience, he knew the Midwest loved him. You know, the coasts, not so much. In the middle of the country, they loved Joe. And Joe did this movie against his better judgment. He thought it was too dark. It was too gangstery, you know, whatever. Turns out it was one of his better movies of the 1930s. It's really good. It's called A Very Honorable Guy, 1934, pre-code, really good. Also, Lady for a Day, Frank Capra's great movie.
Yeah.
Remade as what? Pocketful of Miracles.
Yes.
With another Frank Capra. He remade his own movie. Second time he did that. He did that with Riding High, too. It was originally Broadway Bill.
Oh.
Same amount of syllables. My favorite Edward G. Robinson comedy of all time is based on a Runyon story, A Slight Case of Murder, which is absolutely hilarious if you catch it on TCM. It's 1938. Robinson will make you pee. He's so funny. But they remade it in 1953. I would say Runyon was like the king of the remakes. As Stop, You're Killing Me. It's my favorite Broderick Crawford musical. They turned it into a musical starring Broderick Crawford. And I'm not.
Oh, my God. That's a phrase I thought I would never in my life hear. A Broderick Crawford musical.
10-4, 10-4. There's a bright golden haze in the meadow. There's a bright golden haze in the meadow. There's a bright golden Steve on Jane Meadows.
No, stop. did I just say that? Also, Dean and Jerry made Money from Home in 3D, so you could see how unfunny Jerry is in three dimensions. And speaking of funny, the Ritz brothers, their movie Straight Place and Show from 1938 is based on an unproduced Damon Runyon play. So Damon is all over the classic comedy spectrum and sometimes successfully, or in this case, not so successfully. Now, there are going to be people, I'm sure there are going to be comments, oh, I like it, ain't hey, and oh, la, la. And that's fine. I want people to remember one thing, and I'm going to say this, and it's going to cover all 38 episodes up until we finish the final movie. And we may even go on beyond there if Jerry can take it. But, you sounded like the great Gildersleeve. You did. You just did. I just want to say that I'm opinionated. I've been in comedy for 50 years. I've been writing it, performing it, reading about it, studying it. I'm an educated guesser. And I have opinions. I have strong opinions. And if you don't agree with them, that's what makes life sweet. You know, be polite. Let's discuss, not argue. Some people were real catty about certain things. And I try to be nice and I try to, like, you know, bring it down to human level. But it's not always easy. You know, so let's just understand that we're all different and we all have different things that we like and dislike. Now, here's an interesting story about Damon Runyon. When he split up from his first wife, he ended up going to Mexico. He loved baseball and some of the teams were training down south of the border. So he went down to Mexico and there at the stadium was Pancho Villa. And he started hanging around with Pancho Villa while he was in Mexico watching American baseball. Now, part of Pancho Villa's entourage was a 14-year-old girl who used to run errands for him, bring him back things and whatever. And Damon Runyon was very taken with her, thought she was very good at what she did, a very nice girl. And he said to her, "I will put you through school. What do you want to be?" And she said, "I want to be a dancer." She said it in a Mexican accent. "I want to be a dancer, senor." That'll get me thrown off the internet. I'll do an Italian one, okay? "It's something, it's good, okay." This girl told him she wanted to be a dancer in shows in New York. And he said, "I'm going to put you through school." And it was a convent school. And she graduated. And she showed up in New York and found him through the receptionist at the newspaper where he worked and said, "I'm here. I'm 19 and I'm ready to be a dancer." He got her jobs and speakeasies all around New York as a chorus dancer, and they ended up married.
Wow.
He married the girl. So that's our Damon Runyon. An interesting story. They ended up getting divorced a few months before he died in 1946. Mm. She had an affair with a younger man who didn't have throat cancer, which he died of. Yeah. And now, interesting also in our comedy history, the Damon Runyon Cancer Foundation or whatever it was the very first telethon, 1949 for the Damon Runyon Cancer Institute or whatever it is, foundation. And the host was Milton Berle. Uh-huh. Everybody's waiting for
Jerry Meidman.
It's Milton, it's Berle. So anyway, and I'm surprised, you know, with Milton Berle that they didn't have widescreen TVs at that point. So anyway, that's for you.
That's for you insiders.
So let's get down to this movie. Let's talk about
this. Yes, please.
You just made me giggle. Let's talk about the players here. Okay. We got the main one out of the way, the guy who from the little acorn grew the tree. Abbott and Costello, at this point, an amazing thing happens. In between Whodunit and this film, It Ain't Hay, Abbott and Costello took the summer to make 34 stops in 34 cities.
Wow.
Yeah. They raised $85 million in war bonds. It was a record.
Wow.
And yeah, this is what they did. And it practically killed Lou Costello. Apparently, his health after that trip was never the same again. Yeah. His rheumatic fever, he had a bad heart. And, you know, let's face it, Lou loved spaghetti. He loved to eat. He loved, you know, he was a Dionysian. How about that?
Very good. Very good.
So the boys went out and they did it for Uncle Sam. And this is about 10 years before Uncle Sam did it to them. I'm telling you, I'm still angry about it. Okay. So Universal made this movie 7 years before. They want to do it again. They want to change the name to Hold Your Horses, which makes a lot of sense. But and this sounds like Universal publicity, but they said because of all of the money that Abbott and Costello raised for the war effort, they changed it to It Ain't Hay. I don't buy it, but okay.
Yeah, makes for a good publicity story. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, Joe, what can we say about this? Tell them they're giving out balloons. So anyway, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. This was also an interesting time because when they got back from their tour, Bud and Betty Abbott adopted a 3-year-old baby, sort of out of babyhood at that point.
Yeah.
Named him Bud Abbott Jr. And he became Bud's loving son. They eventually adopted a girl as well, Vicky. So that was it. Bud said that, you know, this is my reward for selling all that stuff. This is my reward. And we got news that Ann Costello was pregnant.
Yeah,
with Lou's third child. And when they finished this movie, when they're just about time to finish shooting in November, little Butch was born, November 6th, 1942. I say that with a lot of respect and reverence. I can never tell the story without crying. And I would do that. I would tell the story to my students when I would teach a class on comedy or an Abbott and Costello, and I can't hold it together. So let's just leave it there.
Okay.
Happy time. And Lou ignores all doctor's orders and whatever, and Universal throws them right into another movie. They get off the tour. They're practically off the train. You know, they're tipping the train guy, and Universal's going, "Come on, we got to shoot a movie. Let's go. There's money to be made." There's a very disturbing thing about this film. and I'm going to say it here and now and get it out of the way. I talk about it in our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello. There are outtakes from this film, and there are two in particular that chill me to the bone. We all heard about, you know, Lou had a hot temper. When he got mad, he was pretty Italian, you know, and he showed it occasionally. And most of the time when it was against the head office, I would probably be standing right with him. But there were times when, you know, he got temperamental, especially as they went on and he started realizing just how popular they really were. But anyway, in these outtakes, there's one where they make their entrance. Their cab, you know, drives into the picture. They get out. The doors fall off. And Bud said,
"You know, you were driving over 35 miles an hour? A minute. 35 miles an hour. A minute. This car won't go an hour.
Why you?"
And Bud just goes, "Why you?" And he forgets his line. So they have to do it again. But Bud has his arm around Lou, or has it on his shoulder. And Lou pulls away from him like he has a disease and says, "You know what? Get somebody else to do this," as he walks away. And poor Bud's trying to smile in the background like it didn't happen, but it happened. And it's not pretty. It's chilling. It's on YouTube. I mean, you could see it. The other one is in the cafeteria scene. Bud, again, forgets to do something. And Lou just looks, he shakes his head and he goes, "The chump forgot to leave me the tickets." Called him a chump. And he was serious. I mean, he wasn't kidding around. So I'm wondering if, you know, that summer of such close proximity after making 9,000 movies, you know, in 2 years, I would think that you'd start getting on each other's nerves after a while.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. So I write in the book that this might have been the time that they had that big argument about the maid. And for those of you who don't know what that is, very briefly, Bud times it at 1945, which is a couple of years later. But by that time, the outtakes tell the story. The outtakes from the movies tell the story. You see how friendly they are in the background when they're fooling around, when they're trying to make the cast laugh. You know, they're getting along. In this one, there are a few moments where they look like they're okay. But then, you know, there are those two moments where maybe this was the time Lou had to fire a maid who was kind of like unionizing the staff, the household staff. So he fired her. She went to Bud and Bud hired her. Now, Bud, you always hear he was such a decent guy. He was such a soft touch. But that was not a cool thing to do. I say it in the book, too. If I were Lou's partner, I'd have to stand with him on something like this. Yeah. So, but it turns out Lou took great offense and the two of them didn't talk for almost a year off stage. They, of course, on stage, they were fine. So I don't know. This could have been Bud's memory might have been off. Or if somebody knows for sure, I would love the proof. Some people say later on they did two movies where they weren't teamed. They played two different characters, A Little Giant and The Time of Their Lives. And people put it there. But no, by that time it was over. They were working well together again. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's it's all there. So anyway, that's my theory. That is my theory, which is mine, is mine. oh, wrong comedy scene.
Abbott and Costello meet Monty Python. There we go.
Oh, boy, that would be fun.
Yeah.
Strange as it may seem, they give cricket players funny names. okay, so this is the last movie with Earl Kenton. This is also the last movie with Alex Gottlieb as producer. I think I said it in the last Whodunit that he comes back 10 years later for Jack and the Beanstalk and Meet Captain Kidd. So he's a valuable guy, but he moved on. He wanted to move on and do something else, and I don't blame him. Okay, so we open the movie with the opening credits. The songwriters, this is also fascinating. I told you that the fascination is around this movie rather than in it.
Yeah.
The songwriters, okay. Harry Revel and Paul Webster. Okay, Paul Webster wrote the words, lived to win 3 Oscars. Later on, the shadow of your shlimmy smile. Yeah. Once I had a secret lunch. All those things. And he was very good with that.
I like yours better. I do. Thank you. I really do.
So anyway, he did fine. Unfortunately, Harry Revel, who was partners with Mack Gordon, at Paramount. Gordon and Revell, they were known as. I later met Harry Revell's nephew, and we were writing a show about him called Revelations. Mm-hmm. And we never got past a certain point. But he wrote some gorgeous songs, wonderful songs. And then he left Mack Gordon. The two of them went their separate ways. And Mack Gordon was wonderful. He was that really round. He was like a Mr. 5x5. And he was the biggest ham in the world. He loved nothing more than singing his own songs by the piano. But poor Harry, the name Milton Doc Bender is a very, very infamous name. He was the drug dealer and, how can I put this, homosexual procurer for Lorenz Hart, who we know was a gay dwarf, basically, who was under the thumb of Doc Bender, who kept giving him drugs and little boys and whatever, whatever they did. He was the ultimate enabler. And unfortunately, Harry Revell was in the same situation as Lorenz Hart. He had to borrow money from ASCAP to pay Bender what he owed him. He died young. He died young in like the late 50s. I think he was really in his 40s when he died.
Yeah.
So yeah, like Lorenz Hart, he was down that road, that horrible, horrible road where there's no way back, it seems. So anyway, those were our songwriters. And the first song is called Sunbeam Serenade.
Yep.
I love old songs. I'm one of those people that actually believed Bing Crosby when he was singing, "Oh, it's great to be poor and you don't need money." You know, and there he was making another investment on a tract of land with an oil well.
You know, I have to say, you were talking about how this movie is, you know, perhaps one of the lesser of their first 11. One thing that struck me right off the bat, when that song started, it struck me that their previous film, Whodunit, jumps right into the story, jumps right into Bud and Lou, and that's all we get. This movie jumps right into this production number that has absolutely nothing to do with Bud and Lou. And it's like, okay, we had a big hit. Now let's go back and do it the way we did it before.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like the trajectory was ignored, but they're not the first to have this happen to them. And I think the first that I can think of and the most notorious of this is Laurel and Hardy. Laurel and Hardy's very first film together was called Duck Soup. And I think it was 1926. And Ollie was the imperious, pompous, you know, constantly humiliated guy. And Stan was the dim, kind of dumb one that would cause most of Ollie's problems. They had it down in the first film. They didn't get it, really, until 2 years later.
Yeah. So
they ignored the trajectory. And that's what happens here. They figured out how to make great Abbott and Costello movie. Two of them, actually. One is a musical and one was a mystery. Okay?
Yeah.
This one... You know, I try to figure out what it is about this movie, and I do have my theory, so we'll get to that. Okay, it's a cute song. It's a, you know, I'm an idiot when it comes to music, when it comes to old music. What's funny is that there is an interview with Peggy O'Connor, who plays Princess O'Hara, and she was Donald O'Connor's niece, and she was in vaudeville from the time she could walk. But she gives these interviews saying, oh, yeah, we shot that in Griffith Park, you know, with the horse and the blah, blah, blah. They were in front of a process screen. And the doubles were in Griffith Park. It's clear. You can see them, you know.
Yep.
So anyway, it's so funny. These people, they're either their memories fail them or they're just trying to, you know, beef up what they didn't do. Okay, that's just the first number. The choreographer, by the way, is Danny Dare. Now, Danny Dare just came off Holiday Inn, where he choreographed Fred Astaire, for crying out loud, the gold standard of all dancers in film. And he comes here, and this is some of the worst choreography. First of all, they're just sitting in the horse thing, doing the song on this one. Wait till we get to the finale. Just wait. Well, we'll hold off on this. Okay. So they're in the park singing the song. Everybody's got good teeth. And they pull up, and apparently the little girl has a horse. He's an old horse named Finnegan, and she loves the horse, but she also loves Abbott and Costello, and they show up in that cab where they have that horrible outtake. But you see, it's amazing to watch the finished take. because you saw what happened before, and they are so professional, and they you don't know anything was wrong. So, you know, you got to give them credit for that. But there's some funny lines here. They break the mutter fodder routine into three parts.
My gosh, yes. It's all through the movie.
It's everywhere. It's so funny. They started with this one. Lou gives the horse some candy. He's not supposed to. The horse is very old. And they start with, no, you shouldn't add. The horse won't eat his fodder.
Now he won't eat his fodder.
Eat his fodder?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think Finnegan is, a cannibal?
No, she's going to hang his fodder on his nose.
Ain't he gonna look funny with his fodder on his nose?
He eats his fodder every day.
Finnegan eats his fodder every day?
Sure.
But what's his funny?
He eats his fodder.
Oh. And what's his mother eat?
Well, she eats her fodder.
Mm-hmm. It's getting worse all the time.
Oh, what's used to talking to you?
Must be Father's Day.
So, it comes down to the fact that the friend of the boys is Leighton Noble. Now, Leighton Noble, I refer to him, I stole this from David Steinberg, the great comedian David Steinberg. He called Zeppo Marx a lox, you know, like dead fish, a lox. And I thought nobody explains Zeppo better than that. And I have to say, if you're looking in a dictionary and the word lox, L-O-X, is there, there would be two pictures. There would be Zeppo Marx and Leighton Noble. He has the personality of drying paint. He's just, oof, ah, ho. Oh. But anyway, he's. I got to tell you, though, of everybody in this movie, he was an orchestra leader into the 1990s. Mm. He even shows up in the movie White Christmas. He's the orchestra leader. So, he sustained a career. I can't believe it, though. They make him act in this, and I say that halteringly. Because I'm wearing a halter. So, Abbott and Costello owns a taxi cab. He actually has a badge saying that. And they vow to help Leighton Noble, because Leighton Noble told everybody in camp that he knew everybody on Broadway, and he was going to put on a big show for the troops. But the only people he could get are Princess O'Hara, the little girl who drives the horse. So that's it. Those are all his friends.
Yes.
So Bud and Lou decide that they're going to help out their buddy. But they run into three Runyon-esque characters. Now, one of them is a guy named David Hacker, who is the tall one. And he does that wonderful trick with the cigarette later on. You got to watch for that. If you watch the movie, watch David Hacker, the tall guy. But anyway, David Hacker plays one of them. Eddie Quillen, pop-eyed Eddie Quillen. He plays Harry the Horse, who shows up in a lot of Runyon's stories, including Guys and Dolls. And then there's the wonderful Shemp Howard playing Umbrella Sam, and he gets the best line in the movie.
It ain't raining. Why the umbrella?
Who knows? I'm a Damon Runyon character.
And I got to say... For all those people that thought Lou Costello was a camera hog and a comedy hog, he gave Shemp Howard the best line in the movie. I'll leave it at that. So, so they invite Bud and Lou to lunch. They're going to talk over stuff and whatever. And in the meantime, they do the second part of the mutter fodder routine at this point. And then they go into the cafeteria. Now, this and the racetrack tout scene are my two favorites. This one really belongs in a better movie. Now, I should mention that in the cafeteria, his first day on the job is Mr. Warner. Now, Mr. Warner is played by that great character actor, that great, wonderful, warm personality, who was one of the biggest racists in Hollywood. One of the most hateful men you could possibly imagine, only matched by Charles Coburn. Eugene Pallett, who was during World War II, he was part of a horse riding military militia ready for the Japanese when they attacked California.
Wow.
He was a sick man. Anyway.
he's in the movie. He's Mr. Warner.
And he's an efficiency expert, and he's selling himself to the head of the cafeteria. And who should come in but Bud and Lou, Shemp, David Hacker, and Eddie Quillen. Okay. Who works there? Grace McDonald. Beautiful, sweet, lovable Grace McDonald. Talented Grace McDonald.
Yes.
Who is let's face it, Crazy House with Olsen and Johnson, Behind the Eight Ball with the Ritz Brothers, Abbott and Costello. I think there are two movies with Abbott and Costello. Anyway, she's just wonderful and as cute as a button. And just backstory, again, the stories are more interesting than the film itself. She was part of a team with her brother, and they were Grace and Ray McDonald. Now, they both did the Broadway show, Babes in Arms. They made a big hit. And Universal signed up Grace, and MGM signed up Ray. Now, Grace, she wasn't really into it at this point. In 1944 or 45, she made her last movie. She got married. She lived very happily into the 1990s. Her brother, unfortunately, he went to MGM, where he played leads in B movies, those terrible MGM B movies, you know, did guest spots in A pictures, kind of what MGM wanted Abbott and Costello to do. But Ray got caught at MGM and eventually had to go to the service. And once he got out of the service, he never regained that momentum again. So it became uncredited spots in movies, a lot of television, guest spots, things like that. Not a happy guy. Actually passed away at the age of 38, I believe it was. He choked on hotel food in New York. Yeah. So poor Raymond. Yeah. Yeah. So we were happy to have Grace in this movie.
Yes.
You know, it was sort of our time of grace. So they're in the cafeteria, and in cafeterias in those days, you would get a ticket. And as you went down the line, picking the food you wanted, they would punch that in the ticket. And then when you were done with your meal, you'd hand the ticket to the cashier and you'd pay your price. You'd pay the cost. I think they're still doing that in places here, in fact. Mm. But here, it's done to great effect. Lou drops his unpunched ticket on the floor. Who should be at the restaurant at this time but a golfer, complete with a bag of clubs and and spiked shoes? He steps on Lou's ticket. So everything is punched. He owes everything for that meal. So he's, you know, he complains. And in the course of complaining, I call it a symphony of crashes. He manages to down about 16 trays full of food, all done beautifully, all done timed gorgeously. Did you notice that, Jerry? Something would fall. He'd bend down to pick it up. As he got up, he'd hit a tray. As they asked him what was going on, he'd point his finger and hit another tray.
Yes.
It was just amazing.
It was a ballet of smashed china. It was incredible.
It was really, it just gets me giddy. But in the course of all of this, and this is the second course now, he ends up with everybody's tickets. That's just how it ends up. The boys bamboozle him. They do a gambling thing and they leave him with all the tickets. So Shemp and everybody is gone. And Lou is left at the table by himself with like $4.55 worth of food that he didn't eat. Now that's about roughly $50 in today's money.
Yeah.
So he's like sitting there with a $50 check that he can't pay. And he hears earlier that Mr. Warner has these three gorillas who, when you can't pay your bill, they beat you up and leave you bleeding in the alley. Now, why these three people follow Mr. Warner around everywhere is beyond me. But they seem to be there where Mr. Warner is, but only in the restaurant. In the restaurant. They don't show up later. The three guys are three of my favorite goons. Mike Mazurki, the great Mike Mazurki, who shows up later in The Noose Hangs High. And Sammy Stein, great old boxer, wrestler, Sammy Stein. And the third one, Matt Willis, who was obviously came over from Columbia because he was the Wolfman in that Three Stooges comedy, Idle Rumor.
Yes.
You know? He used to scare the hell out of me. that was scary. So these are the three mugs, and they're all twice the size of Lou. There's one, we talked in the last thing about Lou when he doesn't say anything and he indicates and how subtle he can be. Mm-hmm. In this one, he turns around, he walks into Mike Mazurki's chest because that's how high he goes.
Yep.
And he steps back and he looks down, he looks up. He tries to figure out how much taller he is than he, when once he figures out that he can't possibly do anything, he accepts it and he sits down. This is all done without words and it's just beautiful. It's why I love Lou Costello.
Yep.
So he sits at the table and of course the three goons surround him sitting at the same table. This is just Earl Kenton, he gets those close-ups of
yes!
the oh my God. And it's like the close-ups he did of the monsters in Island of Dr. Moreau or Island of Lost Souls. It's that same fisheye lens, you know, where they look like they're going to kill you.
You know, yeah. In a horror movie, that's fine.
Yes.
But
yes.
Not here.
There's definite, how can we put this? There's danger. There's definite danger here. So at one point, Warner is talking to Grace McDonald saying,
why is he sitting there? He should be eating something.
Lou hears him and starts eating the napkin. First, he puts salt on it, and then he eats his napkin. So he sits down with the three guys, or the three guys sit down with him, and Lou orders a plate of spaghetti. Now, this is my favorite part of the whole sketch. Mm. I call it his most nervous meal. He's got these three gorillas watching his every move, and he's trying to eat spaghetti gracefully. But thanks to the Universal Sound Effects Department, every time he sucks in a piece of spaghetti, you hear that violin pluck, that bling. And he's trying to describe it to the guys, the three guys, who couldn't give a rat's ass about what he's talking about. He's saying,
it's the roll type. Roll type. We roll it around. It's easier to eat. You don't get smacked with this one. So small smack, that's all.
And they're not listening at all, and he's just going on. So eventually, he's so nervous that he twirls his tie in with the spaghetti and puts it in his mouth and begins chewing. And instead of realizing that it's a tie and a piece of fabric, he continues chewing, and he solves the problem by borrowing Mike Mazurki's jackknife and cutting the tie in half so he could swallow it easily. This is why I love Lou Costello. And Abbott comes up with an idea. He gets the Irish cop to come and save Lou and blah, blah. I don't want to go into all the machinations where they leave the girl behind and blah, blah, blah. So the payoff is Warner is fired. He loses his $100 employment bond, and he has to pay the $4.55 while the boys get away, you know, free and clear. Mm-hmm. So they screwed him over, basically.
Yeah.
Now, this is my main problem with the movie. The antagonist is Mr. Warner. He's more of like a foil than an antagonist, I would say. Yeah. He is a victim of circumstance. The worst thing he did was have those three goons in the restaurant, you know, but they disappear. That's not part of his life. It was something he probably tried that first day at work. You know, he went to his neighbors who had three overgrown sons with high leg problems. So Warner's fired. He's liable for all that money and blah, blah, blah. He shows up later. So Finnegan, this is where, when I was a kid, and you know, this is funny, this movie, you're going to relate to this, I think, because this was not part of the package when I was growing up. This movie was not part of it. In much the same way, it was not part of the Universal release, the first DVDs that they released.
Yep.
And the second, it was not there. It showed up in the Blu-ray collection, finally. It was the same thing with Animal Crackers. It was the original source material. Damon Runyon estate kept it from being out there, realized that somehow that was wrong, and they released it again. Yeah. So now we have it to look at. But when I was a kid, I think I was about 15 when I first saw this one. And all the others I grew up with. And that's one of my theories, is that the things we love the most are the things that we remember so fondly from childhood. Let's face it. It's still burning. It's still burning in our hearts. And that's Abbott and Costello for me. A lot of people ask me, why do you love them so much? Because they were childhood friends and best friends. I'll go even farther. So anyway, Warner is put in that position. Finnegan, the horse, gets sick. Lou knows just what the horse needs. And this is my least favorite scene in the entire film. And I'm not going to say the song I like, it's called Old Timer. And it makes me cry. I'm sorry. I'm very sentimental. About 9 years ago, my very best friend was given 6 months to live. He's still alive 9 years later. He had a heart condition. And I would listen to that song and think about my friend not being here, and I lose it. I still do when I think about that. But anyway, that's me. So it's a very sweet song, and she sings it really well. Why don't I like this scene? We are set up for pathos, okay? Lou is, he really gets a chance to act in this movie, and that's one of the things I like about it, is that he shows us another layer of reality, of humanity. So while this horse is lying on its side, dying, they stop to do the third part of mutter fodder.
What are you doing? Take his pulse.
Not there, in the front.
Oh, by his two front legs.
The horse's four legs.
Four legs? I said by the two front legs.
Well, the horse's four legs are in front.
What's those things in the back, crutches?
No, don't you understand?
They do the old routine of putting the pill in the hose, and the horse blows first, so Lou swallows the pill. Now, bad enough that they're putting these stupid routines, and not that mutter fodder is stupid, but they're putting these inconsequential routines while this horse is dying, while we're crying about, you know, this little girl losing her best friend. I just don't get it. You know, it's what's the word I'm looking for? It's exploitative.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's just weird. It didn't belong there. It just doesn't belong there. And it ruins part of the movie for me. And then the real pathos comes. Finnegan dies, dies. You see it going away in the wagon and, you know, whatever. But we're missing out on something very important that happens. Once Lou thinks he fixes Finnegan, Finnegan is awake. Finnegan's awake. And you see the horse get up, you see, and it looks fine. And that starts a huge, huge musical number that goes on for seemingly 17 minutes. And it's not a bad, you know, it's a, oh, glory be, in a tree. So everybody's in this. There's about 1,000 people in the number. Obviously, a good portion of the budget went into this. And there are several acts within it. There's the roller skating girls, and they are incredible. They're just incredible. That was very popular during the war years, a roller skating act. In fact, there's a movie called Pinup Girl. Filmed at 20th Century Fox in 42, I think it was, or 44. And practically every number is done on roller skates. It was like a big trend at the time. So yeah, we get some of that. We get a singing group coming out of the sewer. and then we get the stepbrothers, the four stepbrothers. Yes, we get another great flash act. That's what they were called, flash acts. They did the same act for 50 years. Mm-hmm. And they would come out, they'd do their 20 minutes, and that was it. They'd get their check, go home, show up the next night, you know, and open for somebody. So the stepbrothers are here. And what interests me about the stepbrothers, you know, Jerry, I thought I'd have nothing to talk about. interesting about the stepbrothers is that, of course, they weren't brothers. You know, can you imagine four brothers called Step, and they're tap dancers. But no, they were just four guys that really danced well together. One of them was drafted, and you know who replaced him? Sunshine Sammy Morrison.
Ah.
From our gang, the first our gang member, actually, and Scruno in the East Side Kids.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one hell of a dancer, let me tell you, and an acrobat. So anyway, so we get those guys doing the great luggage dance. They're dancing on the luggage, and the last guy does that running leap onto the moving truck and lands in a split. God, I'm sorry. They worked. These guys worked. Ugh.
Yeah, they definitely earned their paycheck on that number.
You're telling me. Wow.
I was just going to say, one thing I noticed this viewing, this whole number takes place out in the neighborhood. So they're walking down various streets and coming around various corners to meet these people. And at one point, they walk by a movie house.
I know.
And the poster in the window is Whodunit.
I just spotted it last night.
I had never noticed that before.
All I can say is thank God for Blu-ray. Because I noticed it too.
Yeah.
That's so cool. I think that's so cool. And that movie was hotter than a firecracker at that point. Mm. So this is where the pathos comes in. The horse dies. Lou killed it, basically.
Yeah.
And the little kid, you're a murderer. You killed that horse. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And you know who that kid was? That was little Stephen Gottlieb. Alex Gottlieb's son, the producer's son.
Well, you know, judging from the amount of talent he had in that line delivery, I figured he had to be somebody's kid.
He was in the running for Butch or Buddy. I'm not sure which one. I want to bring up something, and I mentioned this in our book. When Lou wants pathos, he doesn't have to show his face. His best tool, and he uses it time and again, is walking away from the camera with his back to the camera, little baby steps as he walks away. And you know he's totally crushed. You don't have to see his face. And that happens in this movie, and it's just heartbreaking. So anyway, they have to replace a horse for the owner, who was played by Cecil Kellaway, a very, very popular character actor, nominated for 2 Oscars later on. One for, I think, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? And I think the other one for Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla. But I can't be positive. I couldn't even get the real thing. So anyway, they got to replace the horse. They just have to. And they decide that they're going to borrow some money from Big-Hearted Charlie. And Big-Hearted Charlie is played by Andrew Toombs, who I love, who was almost Robert Woolsey. I think I told the story during the real readout. Yeah, but I only mentioned Walter Catlett. Andrew Toombs was also in the running, had Robert Woolsey not worked out.
Yeah.
They go to Big-Hearted Charlie. They borrow $100. The interest is about 300%. And so Big-Hearted Charlie shows off his myocardial bigness by suggesting they go in the next room and bet on a horse and possibly double their money so they could pay him back immediately and still have the $100, you know, that they borrowed. So they decide that this is going to be a good thing. Mm-hmm. Now, this is perhaps the funniest scene in the movie.
Oh, no, perhaps, in my opinion. It is. It is.
And I find it interesting that in my book, I mentioned that in some movies, some of the movies are Lou Costello movies with Bud as a supporting character. Honestly, it just works out that way in certain films, like Mexican Hayride.
Yeah.
And I said that, you know, Richard Lane could have easily played those roles. It had Bud not been a part of it anymore, he would have been a perfect replacement. So he's here working with the two of them, interestingly. And when they poke their heads in the door, they say, Bud says, Stinky Fields sent us. And Lou says, yeah, he's a friend of Shorty McAllister's. Now, Fields and McAllister were a popular burlesque team that were friends with Bud and Lou. Mm-hmm. So they got their names in there right up front. So it's a big scam. Lou is asked to bet on races that are absolutely impossible. One race has two horses, but the third one comes in from the last race. Another race has one horse, and there's a photo finish. It's a wonderful routine. It's vintage Abbott and Costello. And you know what? If you only watch the cafeteria scene and this scene, you'll get the Castle Film version of It Ain't Hay, and you'll get the best of what it is.
My favorite in this whole scene is Lou's reaction to the race where there's only one horse. So he bets on the one horse. The race starts. They're off in a bunch. And then his reaction to that.
I love that. Even his bet. Here, put $10 on the nose. Here, put $10 on the tail. Here, put this under the saddle. What's that for? In case the horse comes in sideways. Oh my God. My favorite thing is it's the racetrack tout. And he says, well, let's look at your form. And Lou opens up his coat and says, well, if you get a kick out of it. So anyway, they go in there and it's Bud saves the day. Good old Bud saves the day. He realizes, because he's a scammer himself, he knows this world better than Lou does. So he finds out that the guys are in the other back room on a microphone, setting this all up. And one of them is Herb Vigran, who was in, pardon my sarong, he was one of the gas station people telling the baseball story. He's the guy who actually saw my comedy act in 1980. And boy, he actually sat down and talked to me about it. He was a really, really good guy.
Nice.
Really good guy. So they end up winning. And they walk out and they pay back the $100. So now they have $100 free and clear. But being Abbott and Costello, that doesn't last long.
No.
Bud makes the mistake of being lazy. What I mean is, I'm going to go over here and have a sandwich. You do a routine on your own. So Lou is left alone to his own devices, and he accidentally is sold a police horse. some guy who looks like he could have a neon sign on his forehead saying, scammer, stay away. I am after your money. Yep. You know, the pencil thin mustache, the fedora, he could be Bud Abbott. So he sells Lou this horse.
Yeah.
And he says, well, how do I know the horse can run? He says, oh, just blow this whistle and it'll run around. So he blows the whistle. And of course, the cop shows up and blah, blah, blah. What I like about this is Lou, he's standing in a crowd while the cop is looking to see who stole his horse or who sold his horse. He sees Lou in back of the crowd, really tall. He's standing over everyone else. And of course, everyone breaks up and he's standing on a fire hydrant. Mm-hmm. The cop sees it and Lou runs off. And beat, Lou runs back on and says, here's your whistle. I'm sorry, but that's going the extra mile. And it just gives you the punch.
Really nice. That good. Was the button on that bit right there. Yeah.
Without a doubt. They could have left it with him just running away, you know, making a noise. But no, they gave it a really nice one, a really nice finale. So they lose the money. And our three Runyon Bunions, Shemp, Eddie Quillen, who I also met, by the way, I actually got to watch at the Vagabond movie theater in 1979. I watched the movie Hollywood Party, in which he was the ingenue, the male ingenue, and I got to watch it with him at the movie theater, and we discussed it afterwards, and he wanted to know mostly where his Senate product was. He wanted to know if I knew where it was, and I'm like, I don't know. It must be somewhere. I mean, you know, they must have preserved it. But he was a very sweet guy, very, very nice guy. Mm. I love the fact that I got there in time to meet some of these people, you know,
before
they were gone. And I'll bring it up. If we get to these people, I'll get clumsy with names and start dropping them. So here's the thing. They're told that the owner of Tea Biscuit, the most famous and most successful racehorse in the world, the owner wants to get rid of another horse he owns that isn't very good. And that's Boimel, B-O-I-M-E-L. I always thought that was an interesting name.
Boimel. Yeah.
You know, weird. So they're told that the first person who comes and takes the horse away can have it for free. Now, that's kind of loose talk. That's, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But they take it to heart and they show up at night at the stable to take Boimel out and, you know, give it to Cecil Calloway so he can have a horse. It just so happens, coincidentally, that Mr. Warner is applying for a job as an efficiency expert at the stables. And for some reason, at midnight, he's having his job interview. And who should it be but our friend in every Abbott and Costello movie in the world, Samuel S. Hines. Anyway, he plays the owner of Tea Biscuit. And he tells Mr. Warner that they are right now in Washington Irving country. In upstate New York. My cousin lives there in Warwick, New York. And that, you know, some people say late at night, at midnight, they see the headless horseman still riding around. So anyway, that's the setup. Bud and Lou decide that they have to get into the stable and get the horse. They start using the gags that they threw away when they didn't use the dream sequence in Whodunit, the Romeo and Juliet scene, where Lou is using the ladder, and every time he steps on it, it sinks into the ground and whatever. Mm-hmm. They use the same thing here, and Bud says one of my favorite lines. This is no time to plant ladders! This is no time to plant ladders? Now, I'm doubting anyone wrote that. And speaking of writers, this one was written by Alan Boritz, who with John Murray wrote Room Service, the play. Which was the Marx Brothers' second worst movie, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. But anyway, he wrote the script for this, along with John Grant, who added the inappropriate mutter fodder while the horse was dying. So anyway, Samuel S. Hines, our buddy, veteran of 220 films, and they were wow. all Abbott and Costello movies. okay, so they're there. They get the horse. It turns out the horse has switched places. They end up with T-Biscuit. They don't know. They give the horse to Cecil Kellaway, who hooks it up to his hack. And he takes Jack Norton, the eternal movie drunk of the 1940s and 50s, early 50s. Mm-hmm. Jack Norton. And he has no lines. They obviously cut a scene. You could see that
yes.
Cecil Kellaway is laughing at something as he's getting out of the carriage in Saratoga. So, yeah, they must have cut poor Jack out. My dad tells me about the time in the late 40s. He was at a movie in New York. And when the lights went up, he got up, he turned around, and there was Jack Norton sitting behind him. He got up and walked out. And as people noticed him, he went into his drunk act, which makes me love him. You know, it's just that's a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah.
Eddie Cantor did something like that with my dad and his friends. They were little kids at the time, and I'll tell you mm-hmm. about that sometime.
Okay.
But anyway, so they get the wrong horse. They have to get to Cecil Kellaway. I wish I could remember the character's name. I can't remember his name.
King O'Hara.
King O'Hara, right. And she's Princess O'Hara.
Princess yeah. O'Hara, okay. yeah.
That makes sense. So King takes Norton to Saratoga for the races, and they have to get to him before the cops get to him because everybody's looking for T-Biscuit, and there's a $10,000 reward. Now, this is where it becomes Ride 'em Cowboy confusing. If you heard our Ride 'em Cowboy episode, towards the end, it gets very confusing with the money and the betting and the that. In this one, here we go. There's a $10,000 reward for T-Biscuit. Mr. Warner and the three Runyon Bunions find out about it, that they have T-Biscuit. But they know that they don't know they have T-Biscuit. They mm-hmm. still think they have Boimel, whatever. This is all so convoluted.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So basically what they're going to do is they're going to give Abbott and Costello $500 for the horse, right? And they'll take it gladly. And then they're going to take T-Biscuit and give it to the owner, get the $10,000, split it four ways, and they all come out on top.
Yep.
Well, it doesn't work out that way. Unfortunately, yep. they steal the finale from A Day at the Races, which I didn't like the first time. there are going to be a lot of people going, he didn't like A Day at the Races? Day at the Races is just like this movie. It's got some wonderful comedy scenes, but you can have it. It's just
yes.
too much. Too
yes.
much. So anyway, the horses are switched. Samuel S. Hines, who owns T-Biscuit, decides to enroll his horse in the race for sentimental reasons because he's so upset that his horse is gone, has been stolen.
Yeah.
So for sentimental reasons, it's up there. It's 99-1. You know, it's not going to win. But the horse shows up. But unfortunately, Lou and another jockey switch horses. And you think that the other horse wins and it doesn't, and it's actually T-Biscuit and whatever. So it turns out that they give the $500 that Warner gives them. They give that to Leighton Noble, the Locks, so he could put on his show. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. He's in this movie. Yeah, that's right.
Remember
I forgot.
Him? Remember? Yeah. 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 Bill Bland. He somehow had his show up his sleeve, and the $500 actually, it made people appear. But due to Danny Dare's terrible choreography, they don't even sway at the same time, these people.
Gosh.
It's like they thought of it on the way there, you know?
Yes.
Oh, it's just terrible. And there's no money behind it. It's like $17 they spent on this finale. It's a finale.
And also
Yeah.
Yes, they do, and they're the highlight of the finale, actually.
Especially when Lou is dancing with them.
Yes, but leading up to that, there are these other acts in this show that he has put on, and it's shown in clip. You know, there's the program, it says the name, you get a fade to, here's a very brief clip of that act, turn the page, ba-bum. They mm-hmm. introduce these acrobats, and they show a clip from Whodunit of
it's the
flying bordellos.
My friend Judy, who's a big Abbott and Costello fan, she actually wrote and sang, do the Flying Bordellas show up in anything else? And I didn't know that until last night, before last, I realized that there was a short, brief, like 2 second clip of the Flying Bordellas. So they were quite popular, from what I understand.
Apparently, yeah.
Apparently is right. Hold on. There's a little note here. Oh my goodness. It's from Kevin Brownlow. I didn't expect this today. I'm so sorry. Jerry, just relax.
Where are we at here? We're at a little over an hour. We almost made it. Okay. We almost made it. All right. Go ahead.
Okay. Here we go. Believe me, you're going to want this. this is unbelievable because this is a really out of Bud Abbott's history. And people don't know this. After Lou passed away, Bud teamed up with Candy Candido. It only lasted about 7 months before, Bud became too ill. But before he chose Candy Candido, he had auditions. And you wouldn't believe these auditions. And he has film clips. They're short, each of them. But we should play this because really, this is very interesting. This is part of his trajectory after Lou passed away, unfortunately, after he passed away. So let me just put this on the old projector here, the old Revere. Okay, here we go. All right, who's next?
Cary Grant.
Oh yeah, okay, Cary. Let's start with this. Okay, Cary, strange as it may seem, they give baseball players funny names. Nicknames. Yeah, funny names, like who's on first, what's on second, I don't know, what's on third. Yes, that's what I want to find out. What? He's on second. Who? Yes. Get out of here. You're terrible. Don't do a romantic comedy with Sylvia Sidney. Get the hell out of here. Who's next? Next.
James Stewart. Oh yeah,
next, get out of here. This isn't
therapy. Get out of here.
I have to reach up and slap him. He's tall. All right, next.
Mr. James Cagney.
All right, ready? Are you trying to tell me that candle moved?
Yeah, that candle moved. I'm telling you it moved.
Get out of here, you short black. It's Candy Candido here.
That's where it cuts off. I'm sorry.
It just interests me that these big names were very interested in the history of burlesque comedy. It's just, I don't know. I find it very heroic in a way.
I find you doing this very heroic, actually.
And if I am a hero, it is definitely him. I said it for you. Okay, so we're at the end of the movie. The finale is very, very underwhelming. Warner is screwed again. See, okay, now I told you I wanted to make a point, what I think the main reason this movie doesn't work for me, other than the other things I mentioned. But Warner is more he's less a villain than he is a guy who is always getting screwed. I don't know. His intentions are not always, they're greedy, and he's very human that way. Yep. And he gets constant comeuppances during this film.
Much the same way people talk about Edgar Kennedy in Duck Soup.
Absolutely. That's an excellent, excellent analogy. He didn't do anything. He didn't deserve it. You know what I mean?
Yep.
The only thing he did, in my estimation, was, again, the three goons, that he had to force people to pay. But to be constantly getting comeuppances throughout the entire movie, and he's not a villain. You know what I mean? Had he kicked a dog or punched the horse or, something along those lines, done something to the little girl, I don't mean that in a dirty way. Stolen her money or whatever. There's none of that. And the very end where they toss him, behind the thing, and it's just not, I don't like it. They're bullies. Abbott and Costello are bullies, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And then they end the movie with a dated wartime joke. They toss Warner over a bar area or whatever. They get rid of him. And his money falls out, obviously. So Lou picks it up, and it's got a rubber band around this big roll of money. And Lou picks it up and says, "Oh, boy, am I lucky." And he takes the rubber band and throws the money away and says, "Rubber, good rubber." And that was your wartime rubber shortage.
Yep. Yeah.
Must have been very funny back then. Not so much now.
Yeah.
So that is the end of It Ain't Hay. This one flew by, Jerry. I don't know about for you, but maybe because I haven't stopped talking for for 70 minutes.
And this is different how? Anyway. Well, but I think you're right. There really isn't as much to talk about in this one. It seems like a drop-off from where they had been building to.
And you know what? Everybody has them. You can't make 170 movies, you know, and not have one clinker. And it's not especially a clinker. It's not a bad movie. It's just not a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it kind of falls in that nether region. And there's another problem with it, as far as I'm concerned. The movie's based on a story called Princess O'Hara. We get to meet Princess O'Hara. She becomes an important part of the story. And then she disappears. There's nothing.
Yep.
She's there. You know, she's there in the chase and she's there, you know, sitting in the chair next to Bud. But that's it. That's it for her. It's just not, it doesn't do it for me. It doesn't blow the whistle for me. And I would come back and give the cop his whistle. So, Jerry, I've been doing most of the talking. I want to hear just from you. I know you're not feeling real well.
Yeah.
Best of your ability. What's your wrap it up on this one?
Well, again, I'm in agreement with you. Surprise. There are moments. And yes, those two scenes probably are the standouts from this film. I have great issue. I'm not as big a fan of the music as you are. I like the music in a lot of their films. Mm-hmm. But to me, in this one, the music is much more of a hindrance.
I do agree. I don't think I think it's one of the weakest scores they had.
Yeah. And I don't know how much of that is the male lead as well. Because, you know, when he starts singing, I'm ready to turn it off.
He does. It's bland. He's just bland. Yeah. A big ball of bland, which is a great thing for Bing Crosby to say. A big ball of bland. Blah, blah, blah.
I do have to say, though, especially in my younger days when I first saw this film, the one joke that just jumped off the screen into my face, I think it was my first exposure to meta humor. Mm-hmm. When Bud and Lou are in the hotel room and Warner is outside and he's pounding on the door.
Go answer the door. It might be Warner.
It won't do no good. We're signed up with Universal.
Go answer the door.
Again, like them calling back Who's on First twice in Whodunit, right?
Yes.
They're aware. They're aware now. They're an institution at this point. And the writers are smart to dwell on that a little bit. So I just feel like there's some gratuitous stuff in this movie that just doesn't fit. Had they got rid of the music and stuck to the plot, and I mean not plot, let's forget about the plot and do a bit and then get back to the plot.
Right.
I mean, let's do what Bob Hope did in Lemon Drop Kid or Sorrowful Jones.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't. Universal was lazy, I would say.
Yeah.
And it was the final film for the two most important people, the director and the producer.
Yeah.
So they had to do all new stuff. And I just give you a heads up, they fixed the problem with the music in the next one. Some of their best music is in Hit the Ice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of my favorite Abbott and Costello movies. So it's going to be the opposite of this one.
Yeah.
In
there
a way.
Go.
Yeah. Jerry, as usual, I had a wonderful time. Thank you.
As did I, sir. I have to begrudgingly confess that I even enjoyed the Bud Abbott clips.
Oh, my
week.
Goodness.
That was,
my goodness. Wow. Wait, hold on. I'm writing that in red on my calendar. Another red letter day for the Baileys.
bunch of garlic eaters.
All right, you two, off you go, through the door or out the window.
I'm all right, George. I'm all right.
I could do everybody in the movie.
Good for you.
Hee-haw. All right. So, Jerry, you have a wonderful weekend. And
you as well, sir.
You all take care of yourselves, everyone, and have a wonderful, wonderful couple of weeks. We'll be back with Hit the Ice. See you soon.